Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint recap from the Center for International Maritime Security. Today, Matt, Grant, and Chris are joined by Scott Cheney-Peters, SIMSEC Director and Chairman. The boys talk about China's new air defense identification zone, naval corvettes, procurement, and Iran. Remember to subscribe to our podcast, available on iTunes, Xbox Music, and Stitcher Stream Radio. We think it's a very fine product, and anyone who says otherwise is probably stealing from you behind your back. They cannot be trusted. Hope you're having a happy holiday. Now, sit back and enjoy the show.
Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. As always, I am your host, and I am joined today by Grant Greenwell, the Operations Officer for SIMSEC, Chris Barber, the Membership Secretary, and for the first time, we've got Scott Cheney-Peters. He is our Director and Chairman of our Board. Welcome, everyone.
Good to be here.
Welcome.
The views expressed here represent the individuals only.
Awesome. Okay, so it has been a busy week. We have a deal with Iran. We have the Chinese setting up their air defense identification zone. And we have had one of the most successful article collection weeks that we've had so far, the Corvette Week. So we've got a lot to talk about. We have some reflections on Harvey's interview from last week. He talked a lot about the surface fleet and where we were going. So we've got some good material on that. But to start out with, any initial reflections, Chinese air defense identification zone. Scott and I actually kind of hit this a little earlier with Scott's article on relationships with the Chinese military as being a way to allay conventional escalation. Mine on the nature of conventional escalation, how relationships may not have anything to do with it. And here, not but a week after we put out those articles, they go putting out this this regulation that essentially, and when this comes out, I'll have an article at War on the Rocks that explains how I think this sets up a backdoor version of sovereign airspace. But initial reflections from you guys on the ADIS, what's going on with it, and what the Chinese are planning to do with it.
Yeah, so this is Scott. You know, it was kind of interesting last Saturday when they made this announcement. You know, we put up a short little article just explaining what it was and what we thought was going to happen, some of the reactions in the region. And so it's been interesting to see just even over the course of the week, sort of the evolution of both what they're claiming it is and is going to be the reactions that actually have occurred as well in the region. So for those of you who are not familiar with what an aid is it is not something that's found in treaty international law, such as, you know, through the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, you've got things like exclusive economic zones, territorial waters, territorial airspace, which are codified in actual treaty international law. An ADIS, an air defense identification zone, is something that something between 20 and 30 countries do have. So there is some normative, customary international law that backs them. However, what the Chinese have done that is different than any other aid is not only are aircraft that are flying through that airspace to the country required to submit flight plans and comply with any sort of instructions, they have also made that a requirement for any aircraft just flying through it, not bound or destined for China. So that is a completely different thing. And then they've also said that aircraft that aren't complying with it, they're essentially, they said they were going to
blow them up. Yeah,
exactly. They said emergency defensive measures. They didn't really say what those were. And then part of this evolution that's gone on through the past week that's been interesting is they then said a couple days later they were just going to shoot flares at those that were not flying towards China but were just simply flying through. And then after the B-52s that the U.S. sent through, we can talk about those in a second as well. After they didn't do anything with those, they said that they monitored them flying through the airspace. They said they're now going to just base their reaction on the perceived threat that they pose. And yesterday they did their first scrambling through the PLA's Air Force of jets to try to intercept some of the foreign military aircraft that were in the airspace. But again, it's not territorial airspace, and it's not anything that's codified in international law. But what the U.S., South Korea, and Japan have been doing by flying aircraft through to kind of, you know, thumb their nose at this new construction that China just sort of out of the blue threw up was, you know, is an attempt like where we drive, you know, naval vessels through the Straits of Taiwan is an attempt to prevent it from being accepted as a norm in customary international law. Basically saying, you can claim this, but nobody else agrees with you.
Yeah, that's a lot what happens in the Gulf, from the excessive territorial claims that the Iranians have from their 1993 legislation. There's a really neat State Department document. I'll put it in the link to the podcast that you can read. But it's essentially they go out and they say, hey, we claim all this territory, and essentially necessitates them to patrol it, and it requires the other players that don't agree with their claims to go and deny it. So when you talk about points of conventional escalation, how countries go to war, essentially what China's done is they have forced themselves and others to come into more regular contact. But one of the major complaints that have to do with the Chinese identification zone is there's this concept in international law known as due regard. This is from the International Civil Aviation Organization's Chicago Convention, kind of where all these international regulations for civil air travel came out of, and the agreement was that, hey, we understand that state aircraft have special missions, special duties, and so they do not have to, for example, file air plans if necessary. They just need to fly with due regard to safety. And the Chinese AIR, Aircraft Identification Rules, is the name for the ADIS's regulatory document, denies that. Like you said, Scott, it's through all aircraft. And some folks say, hey, but the Chinese authorities say in relevant airspace, we will not deny the freedom of passage. But the question is not whether or not you will or will not deny freedom of passage. The issue is whether or not you have the authority to. And so the problem with this document is the first sentence of the AIR is aircraft flying in the ADIS must abide by these rules. It doesn't say what kind of aircraft. It doesn't say what kind of, under what circumstances. And for the rest of the document, there's absolutely no explanation of who these aircraft are. So the assumption must be that it is all aircraft. And that's the problem, is that's what makes it, diplomatic slang, objectionable. Because there are cases where countries make civil laws, but they're merely an enforcement of international laws. So that makes them not as objectionable. In this case, it is particularly objectionable. There's also the issue that they give themselves, through radio communication, informally give themselves the ability to do air traffic control over the entire region that ADIZ is spread. And you can only give yourself that authority through international agreement, which they don't have. The United States has that, I believe, over the Eastern Pacific. So a lot of countries got together and they agreed to give the United States authority over air traffic control over international waters. The Chinese have essentially given themselves this authority in a backdoor way unilaterally. And that, of course, in everyone's complaint, that's the issue here. Grant and Chris, go ahead, Scott.
No, I was going to say, while we're still on the topic of the civil aviation, it's been interesting to see that response as well and how that's changed. And we can get into the diplomatic aspect as well, because we haven't really touched on that or the military response. But with civil aviation, initially, Japan's national airline carriers said they were going to comply with the new requirements to file all these flight plans, et cetera. Then they were, I guess, under pressure. They rescinded that, and so now they're saying, now we're not going to file these flight plans. And now, again, just yesterday, late yesterday, I guess, the U.S. told its civil aviation companies to, for the time being at least, to comply with these new rules. And it's, you know, taking, again, sort of that dual approach of, okay, we're going to at least have our civil airlines file these, but clearly we are not complying military-wise. So there is, it's been very interesting to see how these opaque and poorly worded, you know, ambiguous guidelines have both forced international responses from militaries, the governments, as well as civil aviation authorities.
It is a good way of looking at it, though, because it shows that at least the detractors for the identification zone aren't looking for a fight. The United States and China, or Japan, could easily tell everyone, hey, you're not to comply with these rules. The United States is essentially trying to increase the level of safety. They're not looking for some Chinese aircraft to shoot down an American airliner for the purpose of wag the dog. As many people will increasingly accuse, I'm sure, detractors of doing when this aid is set up for doing these patrols. But of course, those that understand it understand that it's necessary. Yeah, and in Japan, I know Nippon Airlines has refused to file airplanes, but I believe a whole bunch of other airliners. I mean, it's really a mixed bag, and one of the issues I think is going to be is not so much the military response for civil aviation folks, but the commercial response, because China does have the ability to browbeat people with regulatory retaliation if you don't follow their rules. So if you're a company that does business in and out of China, even if flights you have and operations you have aren't entering the airspace, you're probably going to follow these regulations and further set this informal precedent of Chinese control over the region.
Yeah, good point. Now let me pose a question to all three of you guys. We've seen this international response now where it hasn't been just Japan or just the U.S. that's gotten upset about this. Despite the, you know, the Chinese ADAs overlaps with Japanese ADAs, especially over the Senkakus / Diaoyus. Taiwan has also been upset about this because they too claim, the islands. South Korea has become, you know, has been upset over this because it overlaps some of their, EEZ claims. And many of the countries that they have disputes with in the South China Seas have also become, you know, you could argue increasingly wary because of some of the statements saying that once we have the capability, as you pointed out, Matt, that, you know, you need to have the capability to enforce any new international rules or, you know, territories that you proclaim. Once we have the ability, we're going to set up potentially something similar in the South China Sea. So given this reaction, you know, and the refusal to comply with a lot of the rules by the, you know, international partners or international community, do you think that this was a mistake on the part of China? Do you think that they expected this reaction, or do you think that they're simply playing to different audiences? Some, you know, to some degree, they're having to play to the nationalist base within the country, perhaps. To some degree, they're, you know, trying to send a different message to the international community and different members of the international community. How do you think this has gone down?
So this is Chris here. First of all, I don't want anybody to read Hipple's article this week because you won't need to after listening to that. He just went through. I think we might want to
well
do
said.
45 more. I might want to do 45 more minutes on that, Matt, if we can. I'm busting Matt's chops if nobody got my sarcasm through the interwebs. He is a very intelligent man, and both him and Scott know much more on this than I do. But 2 points I would make, and the second one being an answer to you, Scott, will be first, the net benefit I see of this is that it warms my small black lump of coal realist heart to see, that a lot of these international norms / treaties / this is how we'll get the Chinese to do right. We'll incorporate them into these different organizations, and they'll start to mirror us and things will go better, is, in my opinion, largely bunk. I think that a lot of the moves and counter moves in the Pacific are as realpolitik as anyone could find. And, you know, Hindenburg, would be completely at home dealing with the same problem, you know, a century later. So that's point one. Point two, I think that everything that they, I don't, it's too early to tell if it was a mistake or not, but I think this was the first move in a very long campaign that's been very well planned by the Chinese, that I don't think a lot of Americans or international folks outside of the IR realm or some policy circles have really paid attention to. I think this was the first kind of, you know, dropping the China plate move to get everybody to see. Because I don't know if any of you saw it, but two or three weeks ago, there was this great New York Times article that came out, this, like, multimedia presentation they had done called Sharks and Minnows, I think. And it was all
We actually had a short post on the site kind of linking to that just because it was so great. And then another one that the Council on Foreign Relations did on just general maritime claims by China. But, yeah, it was a great one if anybody hasn't checked it out yet.
I got it from SimSec because SimSec is the number one spot for maritime news. Everyone needs to make sure to reiterate that. But, no, I saw that. And one of the things that following it tangentially – you know, not kind of becoming a big China watcher until I got into grad school and got involved with SimSec and just started educating myself more. I was surprised to learn about how active in this, I mean, I had known about stuff going on in the Spratlys, but I didn't realize the Chinese essentially had these kind of GoPlat, you know, oil platform equivalent structures built all over there in order to establish this precedence. And I think a lot of that was more quiet. And they knew that, they understood that, and this is the first real overt move. So the interesting way to watch which way the road will fork will be what these responses do, and then if the Chinese kind of up their ante. My prediction is they will up their ante and they will double down. I don't see anything going kinetic, but I do see, I see them getting in there and kind of wedging their way into a position that's hard to dislodge them from, like Matt's talking about, through this informal precedence establishment. Those are my thoughts on it.
I wonder if they've actually already begun. You see a greater escalatory campaign. I know a lot of people accuse folks, especially in the West, guys like us, of attributing way too much strategic insight, to the Chinese government, sort of, planning for the worst, if you will, every time they make a decision. But it seems very fortuitous that they set this ADIS up at the exact same time that their carrier slowly beginning to come online. And when you look for a way to bridge that gap, you say, okay, you control the air technically in a civil authority way over the Senkakus, but that doesn't mean you really own them. The carrier seems like a very convenient bridge. It's a, hey, I'm just controlling the ADIS using this aircraft carrier, by the way, which also happens to be a ship, which I'll have to defend, which means I need to have security for my ship, which means I'm now going to start exercising authority over these islands. Maybe I'm attributing way too much insight on their part to do that, or rather giving too much weight to its impact. But that's something that particularly I was thinking about, because up until this point, it's just been paramilitary coast guards, lightly armed ships patrolling around, and now it's a full-blown aircraft carrier is being dumped into the mix. So that seems like a massive escalatory move.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much the aircraft carrier really plays into this situation, other than just it is in the background. I'm not sure that the timing of anything like this is always interesting, but I'm not sure that those two are necessarily related. I do think that it was a little bit more interesting that, you know, this came on the sort of heels of China finally getting in on the game in the Philippines and starting up their humanitarian assistance disaster response, where, you know, they finally sent the Peace Ark, which is quite a formidable humanitarian ship, and I'm sure well received and very useful for that mission. But I think, you know, any of the goodwill that they were starting to generate down there has sort of been shaken off by this move, and then fears of a similar zone being applied down into the South China Sea region. And, you know, I talked about in the article, you brought it up earlier, about having potential proactive approaches that the U.S. can take to try to find ways to de-escalate potential conflicts with China, and then also help to find ways of preventing conflicts in the first place with China. And one of the main thrusts that we had was, you know, trying to set up a way to have joint humanitarian assistance disaster response missions and exercises and operations. But the going assumption in there is that you have to have a willing partner from on the Chinese side to be able to make it work. And right now we're just it's kind of one step forward, one step back, where they're, you know, it's hard to tell how much forethought is going into a lot of these moves. And they're always, you know, you never want to underestimate your I don't want to say enemy, because they're not the enemy, but, you know, to some degree, a strategic competitor. And you never want to underestimate even your, you know, willing partners, but, it doesn't always seem like the responses that they hope for is what actually comes out from some of the moves that they make.
I think an antagonist would be the good term for it. One thing on what you did say, Scott, they did have a defense ministry spokesperson come out on a series of questions, and one of them was, will China establish other air defense identification zones? And the response was, they will establish air defense identification zones at an appropriate time after completing preparations, which is a really ominous, maybe that's a poor Chinese to English translation, but a disturbingly ominous answer when it comes to what you were talking about, other countries being afraid that they might extend their reach down.
Well, exactly. Yeah, that's what I was alluding to when they were saying, and then where you were saying, you know, they need to have the mechanisms and ability to enforce, you know, through international law, any of these new regimes that they set up.
Grant, you have, there you go.
Yeah, I've been silent. You know, I think that you're giving the Chinese too much credit, you know, when you allude to foresight and how much planning went into this and how ominous it is that they need to make preparations. I think that's almost a point to them conceding that maybe we didn't do this the appropriate way, because there's two separate paths that they should have taken concurrently to set up the stages. The first is with the State Department and giving everybody notifications. The second is through the ITAO, which, you know, they didn't go through either of them. They just kind of, as you pointed out, unilaterally threw it up there. This is extremely concerning to me. When I was in high school, I lived in Marietta, Georgia, and I got to go by the plant at Lockheed every day when I was a sea cadet, bebopping around Naval Air Station Atlanta. And then all of a sudden, one week, we had this very broken and shattered EP-3 end up in one of the hangars that China had forced down. In the process, you know, compromised a lot of our intelligence capabilities, killed one of their own pilots. And so I'm very cued into missteps by China. This was a tremendous misstep, but I want to say that, you know, the Americans in particular had a very thoughtful, measured response when they flew unarmed B-52s in to the ATIS and just said, hey, you know, we don't have anything. We're not Wings 30. We're not trying to encroach. This was part of a pre-planned exercise that we had. And so that kind of set the stage for letting everybody know that China wasn't really trying to establish any line of hostilities, but they were attempting to put out an area that would help them with identification in that area. My personal thoughts on that are that the reason why they needed to establish NATIS was because simply they do not have the resources now to adequately surveil that area.
That's a, you know, that is a fair point. The language coming out of China is about how this is largely an issue of defending Chinese sovereign airspace. And of course that becomes everyone's question is when you say Chinese sovereign airspace and you're defending it, what are you saying is your sovereign airspace? Because a lot of the, in fact, the entire AIR is a treatment of the ATIS as if it was their sovereign airspace, at least the effective regulatory controls that they give themselves. So it is that fuzzy language, but of course, China is want to often use that language, that fuzzy regulatory language, which gives itself as much authority as it politically sees as feasible at the time. So that is a major component.
And one thing that Scott alluded to was how much we don't necessarily want China to be an adversary in this, but more a peer competitor. And we could have gone in hand in hand with them to the Philippines, really kind of on friendly terms, since we've been training to do that for humanitarian assistance. And there's no reason to make this relationship adversarial at all. It's interesting to me because Admiral Harvey essentially said the exact same thing last week during his podcast with you about any time you go into a region, you don't want to go in alone. You always want to have partners.
Yeah, that's true. And hey, to be fair, it was a podcast with us. You may have ditched Admiral Harvey halfway through, but you know, it was still us at the beginning. Not just me. Now you have a good point there. I mean, politics aside, I'm sure a lot of folks, myself included, would argue that due to the political system in China, there's a point at which you can't be their partner anymore because it's a system that you can't agree with them. Sort of bringing that, you look at Africa and you look at their campaign to bring the sort of mentality of like top down economics there. But that is true. Which was disappointing when the United States decided to not send the Mercy to the Philippines. I know we had plenty of assets in the region and they were doing lots of work, but there is something symbolic about the hospital ship USNS Mercy. And the fact that the Chinese hospital ship is there and the U.S. one is not, is even though if effectively the United States is conducting far more in the Philippines, the image of that ship is important. Chris, do you have any more thoughts?
No, I think, I mean, listen, like I said, cold black, heart of coal, of stone, realist stone heart here. So I guess when it comes to, we don't want to anger the Chinese, we don't want to do this. My opinion is, you know, trust but verify. You know, this is more their backyard than our backyard, but I think that through some really strong, multilateral, bilateral relations with a lot of other people who are worried about what they're doing, and then some very clear responses to what's done, I don't think it'll go too much further. I think it's interesting, and I think Americans should be paying attention to this. I know we won't because we're going to pull back from all international relations in light of just what's going on domestically and kind of, I think, our national will right now. But you're definitely seeing reflections of what I think will be the major question for the next 50 to 60 years. And I think that this is some of the opening things that maybe people will be reading about in textbooks 80-100 years from now.
And you bring up a good point. If you want to see a textbook version of what balancing is, up until this point, it's all been adjudication for the Senkaku. So every single player that's involved has been bandying about, arguing legal arguments, sending little ships, driving around one another. So it's been a very peer playing field. So everybody's been able to, on some level, play in this game. Now that China has upped that ante and brought in the ADIZ, brought in their air power, brought in the carrier, bringing in naval assets. Is now that they've done all of that, is you see all these other players that were all on separate sides of the table, all sort of gathering on the side opposite of China, because they know that if China wants to play hardball like it is now, no single one of them is going to be able to play. So again, it's that textbook version of balancing. That is really interesting to watch.
Well, and this is where I go back to that question I posed. And sorry, I missed a couple minutes. I got dropped from the call. But the whether or not this was a mistake, especially with regards to causing this sort of balancing, because you have a situation where, you know, two of the major powers in the region, Japan and South Korea, really don't like each other that much. They tolerate each other to a degree, and they sometimes work with each other. But China had been really starting to rebuild its relationship with South Korea recently. And, you know, at some level, there was a decision to include a disputed rock or a submerged rock. It's not even an island, so it doesn't, you know, ownership or control of this submerged rock does not confer an additional 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone. It just simply is a dispute over whose EEZ this falls into. And at some level, there's a decision on the Chinese side to include it within the ADIZ area that China is claiming, as well as, you know, just simply abutting very close to South Korea's ADIZ. And this has caused a lot of consternation within South Korea and has done, you know, a good job of antagonizing somebody that China wanted as a partner. So you wonder why that decision was made, if not an oversight, at least some sort of tacit approval to include it in there. So I gotta imagine, and then just the sort of continual retraction and clarification over the past week that if not the original intent to, you know, claim that you're going to shoot down anybody that flies in your airspace that doesn't comply immediately with your rules, at least they did not do a good job of clearly laying out what these guidelines and rules were going to be, unless that was the intention and they wanted the ambiguity so that they could play that to the different audiences and the, you know, both domestically and as well as internationally. But, you know, at this point, it's just kind of conjecture and speculation as to how much of this was a mistake and how much of it was just, you know, was incredible strategic thinking on their part.
I definitely do think it was the language, though. If you look at what the government officials are saying, it looks like they are constantly playing on the difference in that language. They'll say one thing, then they'll say another, and it does give them that flexibility. So, Scott, it actually plays into what you said, is if they say, hey, I've made a mistake, I've overplayed my hand, it looks like I'm not going to be able to maneuver as well in this field as I thought, trying to take control of this airspace. Well, don't worry, guys. I said this and I said this, which actually means this. For example, all throughout the regulation, you see the word should, which to some people say, oh, well, he only says should. He doesn't say you have to. Well, in the end, it says, oh, by the way, if you don't, I'm going to shoot you down. So it's that playing of very different pieces of language that you can play upon whenever is convenient for you. At least I think so. So maybe their execution of this was very bad. It was bad timing, like you say, Scott. I think Grant too, you say that maybe they didn't plan it as well as they thought. But at least I think the language, the ambiguous language, was a purposeful safety valve or bludgeon, depending on what you want to look at for this. If you got any last comments on the ADIS, we'll close with that, and I want to move on to our Corvette week, talking about the Senkakus, you know, small boats, offshore patrol vehicles, that kind of stuff kind of gets important. But before we move on to the new topic, Chris, Grant, Scott, anything, last thoughts, last reflections on the ADIS? I'm sure it'll come up again as we talk about this other stuff.
Just looking forward to the timing and the level of ambiguity in their declarations of ADIS is elsewhere.
That's true. That's a good point. Grant, Chris, you got anything?
Nothing here.
No, sir.
Boom.
Nope.
Okay. So, Corvette week. Huge success. Chuck Hill doing a great job getting lots of great riders. Interesting point for people to pay attention to is the definition of Corvettes. A lot of people talk about them. Not a lot of people talk about what they do. Same thing with any ship. They say, oh, we need new frigates. Well, frigates means different things to different people. And a few of our authors, Chuck and Verbus, both mention, hey, it's just based on size. So a lot of folks come in. Eagle One has his article that I believe came out today, Saturday. So it came out today, which talks about, hey, if a Corvette's just based on size, why can't I have a small drone carrier? Call that a Corvette and keep that away from combat, and that'll be useful. Armando is always a good source of great information, starts talking about OPVs, offshore patrol vehicles, how they're different from Corvettes, how they're more used for constabulary duties, but they're still useful in wartime. So a clutch of great information on stuff that gets talked about a lot on the wayside, talking about small boats. This is where the rubber meets the road. Guys, observations, favorite articles from the week, stuff you've been thinking about, Corvettes, let's kick it off.
I'll swing at this one as the least qualified person in the room to talk on Corvettes. So I think it's been an interesting bit of coverage that is probably not, you know, Corvettes and just kind of smaller patrol ships, something that in, you know, naval and, you know, to a lesser degree, IR circles are not really covered, because when you think of big stick kind of naval, Great White Fleet diplomacy, these are not the things that come up in anybody's writing or really as kind of the imagery and iconography of what we think of. But I am interested in that as we see declining budgets come about and we try to deal with this, and especially for the naval service, I think declining budgets are one of the hardest things, because In terms of capital investment, navies need things, and they need expensive things. But are there some ulterior ways of thinking of that? And what I liked about the Corvette Week is we've obviously seen the growing pains with LCS, but are there ways to do cheaper kind of single mission ships that do equate to presence and they do equate to the ability to influence events? They certainly aren't going to buy you a ton of depth or time in the opening stages of a conflict, but I think to like the Yangtze River Squadron, you know, back kind of, what was it? Pebbles of Sand, the Steve McQueen movie.
Sand Pebbles, yeah.
I think back to things like that, and that really equates to me what some of these ships can do, especially around the Pacific and especially with some capacity building. And I think it's much better to focus on building a lot of PC type vessels or the ambassador class vessels that we know work, and they might not be as, you know, Swiss Army knife multifunctional as LCS, but we know they work and we know we can put them in the water and, you know, turn the turbines and get some reps out of them, and not worry about, you know, the cost and kind of having these little mini Cadillacs, which is what LCS has turned into. And from there, from a technology base that works, you can build on. You know, we didn't end up with the P-38 in World War II, because we tried to build it in 1936. You know, we were building Buffalo dive bombers and biplanes that barely functioned well, and we had to iteratively get better at that. I think that's a better way of going about the business than it is to go down that LCS road of making this magical modular super boat that is claimed to do everything but seen to do nothing.
You know, Admiral Harvey brought that up during his interview too, because I asked him, I said, hey, LCS is kind of a boondoggle. What can we do to save it? Because we have it. It's not like, hey, we have multi-billions of dollars invested in this thing. And he brought up a good point. He said, hey, you know, it doesn't have to do all these things. This modularity, you went down a hole. A lot of stuff that we have today to do, for example, countermine operations, you can just put on it now. You don't have to have a special, Commander Salamander says, Tiffany Navy. You don't need a Tiffany set of countermine stuff. You can just use what we have already. But you as a Marine, do you see Corvettes, small boats as being part of the amphibious equation? I realize that folks are starting to walk away from that thought of being able to kick in the door, but at least it seems like in the sense of bringing a big expensive destroyer next to the shore to do gunnery support, or you on the shore waiting for Tomahawks to come in, you know, which might come in late. Gunnery from ships, we saw it a lot during Vietnam with the small boats that go in and support the landings by the Army. Corvettes for irregular operations and the stuff like that. What do you see that as part of the equation?
So I don't know yet, but I have interesting concepts that I think might be good ways for the Navy and the Marine Corps to kind of partner up and offer some different approaches to lawmakers for national security. So I know a few years ago before LCS, they were talking about like the it was some like missile boat kind of arsenal boat concept that was going to, you know, basically have the equivalent to MLRS or HIMARS, which are, you know, telephone pole sized explosives that we used in Afghanistan. And were kind of, they were created originally to do, you know, fill the gap type stuff against the Soviets. And then we ended up taking those and using them with some precision guided systems to turn them into some pretty good weapon systems. So I think about Corvettes, and what I think about, it would be interesting if we got some very small Griffin missiles and or, you know, ground launched Hellfires and things like that that were close in to shore. And we're doing, you know, maybe some maybe we're doing a different type of mission. Maybe we're doing a feint, or we're trying to do a secondary effort in order to, you know, obfuscate or kind of cover up a main landing somewhere, a MARSOC team or a recon team off of a small boat. Some Navy SEALs with a lot of firepower behind them could make a really good impact. And as we look at kind of that arsenal boat concept of putting a smaller version of HIMARS, a smaller version of MLRS, a smaller, maybe like 120 millimeter mortar or something like that was precision guided, adding some fire capability with some good observers within kind of the near shore area, 5 to 10 miles in. That I think those are interesting, cheap, doable things that we could do right now and integrate them in well. I don't think they have much of an applicability outside that. I don't think as an insertion platform they're great. I know your favorite boat, Matt, the PC, was originally thought of as being this insertion platform.
Exactly, it was. That's what you were saying reminded me of. I was like, oh, okay, he's talking about us now.
So I think that if you had talked to anybody who's ever done an insertion, it's going to be like, no, we don't want to take this 120-foot thing or whatever and get it, yeah, you know, a couple miles from shore. But I think that they can do interesting things like that. And then as we talk about security cooperation, we talk about stuff like that. If we use that, nobody wants to talk. I used the sand pebbles earlier, and obviously it's like, oh, that was imperialism, that was bad, blah, 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 blah. Let's change that construct and let's have a, you know, let's have a fleet of these things working in West Africa.
Yeah, absolutely.
Stuff like that, that maybe we're not doing, like, you know, we're not supporting the opium wars or whatever, but we are supporting some capacity building, countering some piracy stuff, doing small med caps, doing small log caps, vet caps, things like that along these equatorial coastal base areas. And oh, by the way, at the same time, we're showing the flag. We're gaining intelligence. We're getting people cultural understandings. It's a win-win. Something we can do now without investing into, you know, a custom built, you know, platform that Lockheed / General Dynamics / whoever sells us, and we get down this hole that we never get out of.
You know, you mentioned at the beginning, you talked about the Great White Fleet, and I actually think you answered your own criticism there, in that what you're describing is a modern day practical Great White Fleet, in the sense that, yeah, the Great White Fleet was wonderful, it drove around the world and impressed the living hell out of everybody, but at the end of the day, what kind of engagement or support or cooperation did it build? Because that's where we're going today. So if you want the Great White Fleet of today, what you want is those Corvettes, what you want is those PCs, what you want is those small boats. Because at the end of the day, if I send a guided missile cruiser to Tanzania, they'll say, oh wow, that's amazing. But at the end of the day, they don't have anything like that. They can't relate to it. You could probably fit several of their small boats into it, just, you know, on the mess decks or somewhere. If you send a PC or if you send a Corvette to them, it means a lot more than, hey, this country is powerful, but I can learn from this country. And again, back to the Admiral Harvey interview, like with the Brazilians with their small boat teams, you send a U.S. vessel, small U.S. vessel out there to do some cooperation type operations, we're going to learn a lot too, because a lot of these folks that already have these Corvettes, that already have these small boats, sure, their technology may not be as good, but they may have some tactical lessons for us to learn. They may have some operational experience that we most definitely have not had that they can spread to us, and it can create that virtuous cycle of education. Scott,
now,
I think
you're
good.
Yeah, sorry for earlier, a bout of the tryptophan from the turkey hit me and I fell into a brief slumber. But what I was actually going to say is a good tie-in from, you know, you're bringing up South America and Africa, is that what I've enjoyed most about the Corvette Week that's running right now is that it does provide an easy window into a lot of the other of the thinking and the procurement and the issues that are facing some of these smaller navies for our partners. That, you know, we've done a survey of, you know, navies in the Arabian Gulf. We've looked at, you know, some of the smaller navies in Europe as well, and the Philippines, and what some of the issues they're facing with their shipbuilding programs and procurement programs, and some things that, you know, we might not always think about from our perspective of looking at these large gray hulls that we want to, you know, buy and use as a tool to solve everything, but can provide a lot of good insight and thinking and perspective into some of the things that we should be doing, like that you and Chris both just alluded to. And I know LCS is the ship that everybody loves to hate. And I think sometimes the point of, you know, foregoing any real critical thinking about the vessel and what it can bring. But I do agree with you when you said that we are going to have this ship, and we're going to have a lot of these vessels. And so I think the best thing to do if you're a critical thinker is not what platform we should replace it with, because if you look at it realistically, when are we ever going to get, you know, the money to bring in a large, you know, replacement ship class in the near term? You know, we want these vessels if you're a real Navy supporter, and not necessarily just because we want to have, you know, money going to one or the other of the companies building them, but because we want to have the capabilities that they can bring. And I do think they're doing a good job of keeping the cost down currently. I know there's been certainly some inflation from the initial estimates, but as far as the critical thinking that should be done right now, my personal opinion is it should be going towards how to make the ships the best that they can be, and whether that's, you know, a down select, whether that's, like you were saying, you know, foregoing the modularity and just sticking with one installed platform, foregoing, you know, the third or fourth increments of a, you know, mission package, and just going with, you know, some of the basic replacement capabilities. I think we should spend more time thinking about how to best employ them and make best use of them than, you know, fantasizing about what we would replace them with if we had, you know, another gazillion dollars to spend on a new shipbuilding program.
The one thing, though, that did bring up this LCS, brought back the LCS debate, because I feel like for a while people accepted it was a dead horse. It's what we had, and it went away for a little bit. It's always going on in the background, but still, is this issue of those Egyptian missile boats that they'd built, was it Pascagoula? I'm not sure which shipyard down in the south. Which shipyard was it? Do you know, Scott?
The name is escaping
yeah,
me.
Yeah, but it was in the U.S.
or TV Marine or something.
Yeah, they were built here in the United States, and the problem that always comes up with these debates is, hey, this Corvette's better, that Corvette's better, that Corvette's better. And they say import-export controls needs to be built in the United States. LCS is what we've got, so let's roll with it. And still, I've come over to the side of the table that says, hey, I don't like LCS as the best platform, but it is a platform and it has capabilities. I accept that. I used to be a 100% hater, but I see some virtue in the platform because it exists. It's here. I may as well use it for something. But for a lot of presence type operations and conventional deterrence, something like that Egyptian missile boat that we're building for them and we're selling to them, it's built here in the United States. It's a platform that we could have today at relatively low cost, because the R&D cost is gone. It's already out. It's already in the water. So I think that's what brought it back. And we would do well to consider, hey, since we've cut the LCS numbers, if we do want to build fleet numbers, if we want to put guys down in Singapore, if we want guys patrolling around the Pacific, we want to do that pivot. Is it a low-cost backfill option? Would be some of these small missile boats. And I'm sure some folks would have arguments against that that have far more technical knowledge than I do on the platform. But to me, it just seems
just
super
just
superficial.
A small point. We haven't actually cut LCS numbers yet.
Oh, not officially? That's only a policy intention?
I think that's just speculation right now. There hasn't been any official cutting of LCS numbers at this point.
Okay. I suppose it takes time for them to enact the legislation if they
do. And that was VT Halter Marine was the name of the company.
I think we really need to get out of scalpel surgery with some of these defense programs and really get into kind of Civil War hacksaw type surgery, because
Sherman's march to procurement.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm saying we gotta just amputate some of this stuff, because we're gonna get death by a thousand cuts, where if we can't really get into a needs-based examination. And again, I'm speaking as a guy who really doesn't know what the heck he's talking about. But I look at things like JSF, like LCS, and all I see are the albatross I don't know the plural of albatross.
Albatross.
Hanging around our neck for the next war. Because we're going to have these, you know, systems that are just, they don't seem in any way, shape, or form functional. And when the next war happens, which I have a sneaking suspicion, it's not going to be something that'll be that'll start as easily as, you know, arguably the last few started, when you look historically. You know, we won't get to choose the time and place of our intervention, so to speak.
You know, Chris, as somebody who lives in the resourcing and requirements world, I will say that I think you're on with that if you want to save money and you want to have, you know, systems that work, the easiest thing to do is to buy them, you know, commercial off the shelf. But, you know, the development side is where, you know, you really start to kind of drive up a lot of the costs. And it's a lot easier to cancel programs outright than ever try to drive costs down. So when people say, you know, we need to reform the procurement or, you know, requirement system so things are cheaper, then your response should always be, okay, so explain how you're going to do that, because it's a lot easier to throw stones. And that's not what you're doing. I'm saying
I'm throwing stones. Yeah. I you don't have, it's fine. And no, Scott, and I'm with you. And we just were having this debate in grad school with, you know, one of my very, very intelligent professors who is of that mode of thinking. And everybody that's ever, and I have never done this, I've never been a procurement guy or an acquisitions guy. And it's amazing that everybody that's been in that world says, like, hey, it's a lot easier and this is a tough system and maybe we just got to live with the way it is. Correct. But, you know, infant mortality for most of human history was above 70%, right? And we could easily been like, you know, this is just the way it is. It's tough to have babies, you know, 2 out of 3 are going to die. So we just gotta live with that reality. And so, and that was maybe the only time in a defense podcast somebody's talked about dead babies and infant mortality and then compared it. So I'll claim that Guinness Book of World Records.
Excellent.
So my response to that and my solution is that here's a couple easy fixes. Let's stop, and I forget the exact terminology, whatever the defense, you might know it, Scott, the we're going to buy it before it's ready methodology that they've sold us on JSF and LCS. That's, I forget what it's exactly called. But basically, hey, we're selling you the prototype, you know, in kind. You'll start to use it, and then we'll fix it later. We need to stop buying the beta versions of things. And then B, we need, you know, companies, contractors need to share in the cost of failure. And I get that, oh, my God, these programs are so big that we might, you know, if we make them share in that cost of failure, they might not exist, and then we won't have a defense industrial base and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Don't believe it for a second. Don't believe that for a second. If you go back and read a great book called Arsenal Democracy about pretty much the economic kind of defense buildup side to World War II, you know, everybody has to look at Lockheed and General Dynamics and these big companies. I think like 60% of the actual output for World War II, that amazing kind of engine unleashing that totally changed our economy and society, was done by like private farms. You literally had like, you know, or private firms. You had small family farms, you know, making 50 caliber rounds for machine guns in machine presses in their garage. And you had tiny little mom and pop, you know, soda stops also sewing uniforms for the, you know, for the army or whatever. And that was the case that I'm sure a lot of those people failed, but I'm sure there were a lot to take their place. So
Chris, I'm going to have to respectfully disagree with you because while I agree with you philosophically that these are, you know, you should never not do something because it's hard. You know, again, you just kind of threw out a couple of philosophies, a couple of slogans, but not really any practical, you know, hard and fast measures that you would take in how you would implement that, because those are some, you know, those are things that you would generally support, you know, not buying something that's not fully developed and, you know, making sure that the company is sharing the risk. But then it's the implementation of that where it gets very, very difficult, which again, shouldn't be a, you know, a reason not to try to do it, but that's where it isn't easy. It is hard.
I mean, I'm a layman arguing with an expert, so I'm at a disadvantage. But
I'm definitely not an expert here.
I think
maybe
Chris, I think what you're arguing, I think you're actually, Scott, you might be talking to a different argument. Chris is arguing the free market aspect where he says if one person can't do it, someone else can. Now, I'm with Scott that I might disagree on the concept that, you know, what we were talking about in World War II, we saw that R&D was a lot easier, you know, and we're not counting the atom bomb here, but when it came to the development of new fighters and new tanks, it was relatively simple concept, but now we have everything's networked, everything uses composite materials. It's not as easy for somebody to go out into their garage and throw together a new fighter design. It was a terrible conflict, but an amazing time for innovation, when it came to the defense industry, but, I mean, maybe. I guess we've never tried it that way in a modernized, when it comes to modernized defense equipment, is the, hey, if Northrop Grumman can't do it, well, guess what? We're just gonna open the floor and somebody's gonna know how to do it because there is money to be made here. And I think that's the argument that you're making.
Well, okay, so yes, it's a slogan, don't buy things in beta version, but it's also a mode of behavior. Don't buy things in beta version, like, we don't need to buy the JCF until it works, the JSF until it works. We probably shouldn't have signed fully onto the LCS. And the second piece of practical advice is, you know, make companies share in the cost of failure. Right now, these companies have locked in, you know, contracts that are essentially, hey, I can sell you something that's not going to work and you're locked into buying more of it. You know, they've worked a system that we don't have a lot of ulteriors to the F-35, alternatives to the F-35 right now. And that is not to the advantage of the buyer, i.e., you know, the U.S. taxpayer. So I
will tell you that there's a lot of the perceived advantages of what you're talking about, fixed price contracts, don't always pan out in a lot of ways. And when you're talking about the, you know, not buying it before it's ready, it's a little unclear at what stage you're talking about the buying it, because, you know, you come out with a lot of the sort of technology demonstrators ahead of time where you're expecting, you've got all the prototyping going through, and I'm not sure if you're talking about, now with ships, that can be a completely different story as well, because you've got, you know, like, you don't really have as often a demonstrator in your actual ship class, but when you're talking about aircraft, especially, you know, like, we might have only one or two for a couple of years, because they're working out all the kinks before we develop all of the, you know, before we go into full rate production on, you know, you don't want to build 200 of them or buy the 200 of them, you know, before that they're ready to come off the production line. But at the same time, you do, to get a better price, you often want to lock in those prices ahead of time so that you're not then paying, you know, 2014 prices when you could have gotten them for, you know, 10 prices. And then
that
goes into all the structures of the contract. So it's again, it looks a lot easier from the outside than it sometimes is, but I do agree with you philosophically, and actually going back to Matt's point and your point about, you know, bringing in the free market, you know, free enterprise aspects of it, to tie back in our you know, penchant and pet project of additive manufacturing and 3D printing, that's one way we kind of hold out hope in the future that we'll be able to bring back in some more of these at-home tinkerers on even more advanced type of materials and weapon systems that they could potentially do at home, and, you know, start coming up with creative designs at home to sell to the, you know, the Defense Department.
Hold on. I got to fix my soapbox. I fell off it for 1 second. I'm just going to adjust that. No, Scott, I'm on board with you. I think that of course it's complicated. I'm not trying to say it's easy and, hey, if we cut LCS tomorrow, the Navy's procurement woes would be inherently fixed. I'm not saying that. I also lack the expertise. You know, I am literally a crazy street preacher yelling on the corner. Okay. I'm by no means an expert here. I'm just what I've read and the things I've dabbled in. Now, I've kind of been going after the provider supplier side. There's a problem on the buyer consumer side, i.e. the DoD. And we need to stop trying to get these super whiz-bang Swiss Army knife do-everything systems. And that's part of the problem.
Agreed.
Do we need our fighters to be 40 years advanced past the next most reasonable threat? Do we need a small littoral combat ship to be able to blow up a gigantic capital threat, deliver SEALs, have a helicopter, do anti-submarine warfare, and also do humanitarian assistance? I think those are things that are unreasonable on any buyer. If I went into the Apple store and said I wanted my iPhone to microwave my chimichanga, I would have problems. you know, and that's what the DoD is trying. That's what the DoD is doing essentially. So there's a buyer problem. And part of this is just my personal experience of being a guy that was told, you know, hey, we have all these whiz bang amazing systems, and then having a bunch of guys in pajamas, effectively defeat those whiz bang systems and blow up a bunch of my friends. So I have an inherent distrust of these whiz bang kind of salesmanship aspect, sales aspect of how they do everything, because they'll do 20% of what they were sold of doing. My answer to Scott's original, you know, how would we fix this? I already gave my corrections to the supplier side. The buyer side is DoD needs to get much more realistic in terms of what it can expect out of systems and kind of build from what we know instead of take these wild leaps forward and hope everything catches up. Cause that's what we did. You know, when we were fat and rich, we could buy the jet ski and keep the pantry stocked. We're not fat and rich anymore. We can't have the jet ski. Let's focus on buying and keeping the pantry stocked with groceries. That's what we need to do.
And I think of folks that might argue with that perspective are missing is that when you say whiz bang, and a lot of us use that term, we're not talking about technology. Technology is good, but like you said, off the shelf. I think the crux of your argument is that maybe not commercial off the shelf, but it has to exist on a shelf somewhere. And I think that's what you're talking about. And people fail to understand that when we talk about the technological debate, as people say, well, technology is good. What are you guys, stupid? You want to run around with horses? And you're like, no, we want technology. Technology is great, but we want technology that exists. I'm not going to go out and buy an iPhone 8. I don't even know what it looks like yet. But so why would I buy it today? That's insane. Somebody could hand me a friggin' brick with a useless keypad on top of it. That's not what I want. And since I don't know, we're not going to play Here Be Dragons into the unknown with the defense budget. It's too important.
Agree. And I think the point that I really like to get back to a topic both you guys, I think the answer to a lot of this is platforms over payloads. I think that we can do technology, and I don't mean, you know, off the shelf in terms of, hey, we can go to Home Depot or Best Buy and pick this up.
Yeah.
But we have tons of, you know, R&D, federally funded R&D centers, DARPA type places, universities doing work that I would rather support that than go and buy, F-35, you know, based on a shiny brochure instead of like funding somebody who's going to develop the next equivalent of GPS and that does that specific job. Hey, this is an axe. You know, it'll do this one job, but down the future, we might find a new job for it. And it might be used in these ways that we didn't see. Because we're never going to know those third and fourth order effects. But if we build a good product that works well on that first order effect, it'll get taken and it'll get used in a new and creative way. And so that's what I mean by, you know, if we fund that more kind of payloads oriented, a lot of people can use this thing. It works. It's effective. And build those platforms around that and make them simple and less all-encompassing, I think that's more of a pathway and a roadmap to success than what we're currently on.
So you're almost arguing for more of an A-10 version of procurement. You're like, I have this sweet capability I want. Put it on a plane. Go do it.
Sure. I'd say the mode of thinking that I would use for it is the Hellfire, okay? The Hellfire was made to blow up a T-72 and to fill the gap. We never thought we would be killing, you know, Anwar al-Awlaki with one 30 years later, nor did we think we would be developing it to, you know, penetrate into the side of a hostile ship or potentially have a kind of hover capability or loitering capability to provide ISR and then shorten the kill chain. All these things we never thought.
Wait, whoa. Say that again. So Hellfire missiles just drive around?
They don't do that, but they're talking about building later models that would be able to.
You know I was about to say, I said, this is a whole world of stuff I'd never even heard of.
No. But they're talking about building off of that on later versions. So, and that's what I'm saying is you look at that original concept. It worked. It did what it was supposed to. It blew up a tank. And then because it worked and we built it into these other kind of branches of the same tree, we were able to go that far. Compare that to something like the, you know, F-35 or Army's Future Combat System or these things that were sold to do everything and unproven And then we kind of said we were going to play catch up later. I think that's a bad way of doing business compared to that. And the Hellfire is a platform, or excuse me, the Hellfire is a payload. It's not a platform. So it's easy to design that thing so the Navy, the Army, the Air Force can use it. Everybody can use it. Instead of saying, oh, we're going to build this thing that, you know, is going to carry troops and deliver fuel and, you know, do this. It just doesn't work. We're too diverse in our roles and our mission sets.
So what you're saying is essentially that in trying to pursue payloads over platforms, we've actually gone to platforms. Like LCS, you're saying it's not about payloads. You've actually built a platform and you've completely.
Yes.
That's okay. You know, that's a really good point. I hadn't thought of it that way. We're getting towards the end here. In fact, we're a little bit over the end, but that's okay. The one topic we haven't talked about yet, and I'll get a short reaction from everybody, and then we'll close it out. The Iran deal. It's a big deal for guys in the Navy because there's so many guys floating around Fifth Fleet, driving in and out of the Straits of Hormuz. What do you guys think? What does the deal mean? What do you think of the deal itself? And of course the recent Iranian reaction of differences in the meaning of the actual treaty. Chris, I'll start with you. I kind of feel like I know where you're going to go with it, but we'll start with you.
I've already talked, I think last time we talked about briefly, the only point, another SimSec member, Jeremy Rinkin, he raised a really interesting point when we were talking about this, and that, you know, the Middle East is essentially, maybe we're seeing the beginning of the 30 years war that they need to have to kind of figure out their internal machinations and how to, you know, not kill each other over religious scripture. But the interesting point he raised is that, hey, when you see the Saudis and the Israelis starting to work together, which is what's happening, you are seeing some tectonic shifts along the kind of political alignments within there. So I think that adds more precedence that we are seeing some type of, I don't want to call it a 30 years war, but a 30 years change, in terms of how the Middle East is going to be organized and see itself, you know, societally, culturally, religiously, and everything. So that's the interesting part that this brings up for me.
Scott? No, Scott. All right. So it's just me. Yeah, just,
I'm sorry. No, I still had your, I was just going to say, I'm not really an Iran expert, but, you know, from an outside observer sort of perspective, you know, I think it's a good start. You know, it's certainly not the end of history there, but I think it's a good start, and it's going to continue to be hard even going forward though in getting the deal to stick, both passing it through Congress and, you know, making sure that, you know, it's enforceable and the devil's in the details. So we'll see what goes forward, but I certainly think it's a good opening that we have the opportunity to try to pursue.
I think it's too great of an opportunity to avoid. We talk about needing to pivot, and we do, away from the Middle East. Is I think a lot of the recent dust up between the White House and Iran is just bluster, because you don't put that much work into creating a deal announcement to the entire planet and then throw it by the wayside. I mean, Iran can't look like it's totally caving to the West, so having an open disagreement with the White House would seem to be a politically savvy move for a lot of folks that are reading and digesting what they're doing today. But I mean, it is trust but verify, but rather it's verify then trust, because as the president said, you know, I think it was Secretary Kerry who was the president that said, we have no reason to trust Iran. It's not based on trust. And that's true. It's not based on trust. It's based on strategic need and a lot of resources being spent on this one place that doesn't have as much as the strategic impact that perhaps we would want it to. You guys got any last comments? I think we're done here, ready to get everybody back to spending the holiday weekend with their families.
No, I'm just going to go enjoy some more eggnog.
Perfect. Chris?
Go Broncos. We will be beating the Chiefs tomorrow night. I want to hopefully get all SimSec members out to our meetup, which I badgered Scott into doing south of the Potomac River. In Arlington or Alexandria this time. I think that's coming up on the 11th, Scott, or the 10th, or when did we decide?
It's on the 9th. You know, Chris has, been, you know, crying about this for the past several months, and then he just drops the ball and doesn't do anything to play.
No, I'm the big idea. As you pointed out earlier, I don't need to bother with those details. I'm the big idea man. So, you know, we got a place, we got a date. Everything else will settle in emotion. But no,
we don't have a place yet. Voting is ongoing in our, if you're a member of, SimSec, and as always, we encourage you to apply for a membership. It's free. It's a pretty short application, but we love getting, you know, new perspectives and new insights from people. So check it out on the website. But one of the things that gives you is the, you know, opportunity to participate in our internal discussions on Facebook, where we have some pretty raucous and wild conversations, as well as we've got a poll right now going on for our DC chapter as to where to hold the meetup in December.
Democracy in action. See, you get to have a say where you drink your beer and eat your wings and talk about vague esoteric foreign policy discussions that your significant other will not want to participate in.
And then Chris Barber sits in the corner talking about his M4 nonstop.
So I want to invite everybody out to be there because it's the first time it's not been done on a night that I'll have grad school for quite some time. So I'm excited. I will be there with bells on unless work gets in the way. And other than that, just join CIMSCC.org and please follow us. And just like Scott said, add to the discussion.
Exactly.
And if you're not in D.C., we are starting up chapters elsewhere. We just have our first New Caledonia chapter. So if you're in the Asia Pacific region and you can't make it to New Caledonia, consider starting up your own. We've got some founding elsewhere.
Talk about jumping the shark, man. We don't like start like, oh, we're going to go Baltimore, Norfolk. We go big. We go around the world to start our second chapter. So
exactly. Well, soon we'll start having landlocked ones in Mongolia. Yeah, exactly. As Chris said, follow us at CIMSEC on Twitter and find us online at www.cimsec.org. We will be having our event next week, so sign up, as a member and get to meet us all there for the first time. And if you're in Norfolk, let me know. I guess I am the Norfolk chapter. And there's a few of us running around, but we're all too busy to organize ourselves, busy and or lazy. I'm sure Chris will suggest that we're actually lazy. As always, this has been another episode of C-Control, and it's been a pleasure, guys. Thank you very much. Oh, and subscribe to us on iTunes, Xbox Music, and Stitcher Streams Radio. And as of next month, you won't be able to subscribe on Zoom because it doesn't exist anymore, and I'll have to replace my MP3 player. Yeah, screw you, Chris.